Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to On Brand with Alf and me, Rory Sutherland. Each month, I'll be talking to household names as well as challenger brands about success, challenges and future opportunities in the advertising, marketing and media industries. And today I'm delighted to be joined by Emily van Popperinke, co-founder and CEO at Oddbox. Now, this company was launched in 2016 in an effort to save fruit and veg from going to waste simply because the produce was, as they put it, wonky. Its first step was to create a sustainable box subscription service, buying imperfect and surplus fruit and vegetables direct from fresh produce suppliers and growers for a fair price, before delivering them to homes and offices for 30% less than other similar services. To date, Oddbox has delivered an amazing 5 million boxes to UK homes, saving over 34,000 tonnes of food from going to waste. Plus, the company donates up to 10% of its produce to charities fighting food poverty. As fruit and veg supplies in Britain is a pretty hot topic, I'm delighted to welcome Emily to the podcast. So, Emily, welcome. Can you tell us, as we always ask, obviously, I think your listeners will soon detect that you're French, albeit with a, I suspect, a Dutch surname. How did you end up starting a British company?
Yeah. So thanks for having me on the podcast, Rory. But I'm indeed French. I'm from the north of France, so my surname is a Flemish surname.
Ah.
So that's where it's coming from. So I grew up in the north of France, and my grandparents on both sides were actually potato farmers. So I didn't know about the issue of waste until 7 years ago. And so I moved to the UK 13 years ago for work. And I was amazed by the fact that I could get strawberries in winter. And I could get any types of fruit and veg at all time of the year. And that was quite different from what I was experienced in France. And then I worked in India for several years. And there, again, you get mangoes 3 months in the year, but you can't get them at other times of the year. And so that amazement quickly turned to disappointment, because these strawberries in winter, they didn't really taste that great. They were obviously imported from Spain or North Africa. They had been picked unripe, and they kind of lacked that sweetness from ripening on the plant. And growing up in the countryside, we had strawberry plants in our garden. And so I kind of knew what it tasted when you pick them up in the summer directly from the plant. And so at that time, I was frustrated, but I didn't really know what to do about it. And fast forward 5 years later, we went on holidays to Portugal, and there you do the shopping at the local market. We tasted amazingly tasty and juicy tomatoes, which looked ugly. And that brought me back to thinking about that disappointing strawberries experience. And it made me question why I couldn't get such tasty tomatoes in London. And so when kind of I started looking into the food supply chain, that's when I realized the extent of food waste. And at the same time, there was a campaign by a French supermarket on wonky fruit and veg. And I thought, oh, that's amazing that people don't know about this issue. People don't know that up to 40% of the food we produce is wasted just because it doesn't look perfect. And potentially there's an opportunity to do something about it, to actually provide this produce which are perfectly good to consumers, but also tell them about the issues in the food supply chain and try to communicate or educate them about what I had learned myself. That was the beginning of Oddbox.
It is very, very interesting, I have to say, in that you have, I suppose you have a case where this quite often happens in business and in general capitalism, which is there's a particularly decisive moment in the purchase cycle where the attractiveness of something really matters. Now, you might argue there are some cases where the attractiveness of fruit does matter. You know, if you're preparing food where the aesthetics are absolutely everything, but that's probably 10% of the time. You know, if you're making soup, obviously the shape of a vegetable is, by definition, completely irrelevant. And yet, because this, because the appearance of these things is ridiculously decisive at point of purchase, it gets completely overemphasized. I always make this point about camping equipment, okay? That whenever you buy something like a sleeping bag, obviously people at the point of purchase are massively impressed by a really small sleeping bag. The result of that is that every time you use your sleeping bag, it's almost impossible to get it back into the container because the container is made absurdly small just to make it look good at the point of purchase. When actually, when it comes to actually the point of consumption, you'd really rather have bought a slightly larger sleeping bag, which you can actually roll up and put back in the case.
Indeed.
And so these kind of things seem to be quite persistent. And what I didn't realize until I actually got involved in this podcast is the extraordinary percentage of waste, which is purely on aesthetic grounds, not on taste, not on quality. Actually, there's possibly a little bit of an inverse relationship, I think, between taste and quality, as there has to be a trade-off, if you think about it. If you're optimizing for appearance. Yes. But and with strawberries, I also have a complaint that this particular breed called El Santa, which is not a particularly nice kind of strawberry, but maybe is particularly well suited to growing on polytunnels or something. It's a very, very boring breed of strawberry, but it seems to disproportionately predominate. And so you spotted what is actually, you know, beautiful example of capitalism in the sense that you effectively spotted an asymmetry, which you could quite rightly exploit to the benefit of everybody, because it's the benefit of growers. It's emphatically the benefit of consumers and the benefit of the planet.
Yeah, that's what we say. Yeah, it's a win-win, actually, for the growers, for the consumer and for the planet.
So for the growers, this is pretty much incremental money. What were they doing with sort of wonky fruit and vegetables before? It would end up in pigs or something, would it? Or
so it depends. So mostly growers don't want to throw away any of the produce that they grow. So they'll always try to find an outlet for the produce. So it might be that they're able to sell it at the wholesale market or for juicing or processing. At kind of quite low margins or at a loss, or it might go to animal feed or anaerobic plants, so which make energy, or it might be left in the field because it's just not economical to harvest it. And in that case, they kind of say it's fertilizer, though the produce was never meant to be left in the field.
That's a clear-cut case. What you may not know is you're actually in the footsteps of one of the great advertising men of the 20th century, was a J. Walter Thompson copywriter called James Webb Young, who wrote various books, A Technique for Producing Ideas. And when he retired to an apple farm in New Mexico. Now, New Mexico is at quite high altitude, and the thing he was beset by was the fact that before the apples reach ripeness, there'd typically be a hailstorm. And this would cause the apples to be pitted a bit like a golf ball because they were hit by big lumps of ice. And so he did the classic advertising thing, which I'd call alchemy, which is actually turning a weakness into a strength. And he sold them through mail order in the United States in the 1950s as genuine New Mexico hail pitted apples and charged a premium for the wonkiness. Okay.
And that's funny because actually the first apple crop, apple growers that we worked with, we rescued one of their ale damaged apples. So the ale kind of there's mainly ale is around March, April, so when the apples are tiny. And so it got pitted when they're really small. And when they grow, it impacts the skin aesthetics, but it didn't impact at all the quality. But that grower, we helped them sell all the apples that a retailer didn't want because they had this ale damage. So that happens as well in the UK.
And I also suspect you may be benefiting from a kind of reverse heuristic, which is people now see imperfection in the appearance of vegetables as actually, or fruit for that matter, as being evidence of taste. In the sense that one of the things we've probably learned is that, I don't want to offend your near neighbours to the north, but those very perfect Dutch tomatoes are pretty goddamn boring if you contrast them with the, slightly bulbous and unusually shaped Sicilian type. And so I think actually you probably will benefit from a kind of placebo effect where people have come to associate stranger looking fruit with a better taste. Because patently, if you are optimizing for appearance, you aren't optimizing for taste.
Yeah.
And there is going to be a trade-off present there, which I think is really, really interesting.
Yeah, and also obviously we work with suppliers who sell to retailers, so what we get is not necessarily don't necessarily taste better. However, surplus, so we don't only take out of specs or what is called as wonky. It's also a lot of surplus, and there's more surplus when something is in season. And when something is in season, it obviously tastes better.
Of course. Yeah, that makes perfect sense. Have any retailers cottoned onto this and have started doing the same thing themselves? Because it would only take, it would seem an intelligent thing to do.
It's been, even when we started, Asda was doing wonky veg boxes. There's always been different categories of produce. Typically, they don't always call it wonky now because it's more trendy. They call it kind of the wonky, the misperfect. It was always the lower class or lower qualities. It's always been there. It's lower margin, so it's not in the retailer's interest to promote these cheaper alternatives.
So their fear is it cannibalizes the... Yeah. You see, retailers could learn a trick there because you could actually promote it as a virtue and actually charge the same.
That's where it's a challenge for us, and it's a challenge for them, and it's a challenge for the industry, that by selling them for cheaper, they've made it appear as if it was lower quality and therefore it should be cheaper. And in that sense, they don't want to promote it too much because it cannibalizes the higher priced produce. And to your point, there's no reason why it should be sold for cheaper. But that's always the question that we get asked, why what we sell is not so much more cheaper because we're rescuing it and because it's wonky. And also the challenge for retailers is that if they promote it too much, they need to maintain consistency of supply. And there's not always consistency of supply in terms of out of specs because growers are trying to kind of grow in specs. And so often if they promote it too much, they end up having to put class one produce in the class two, the wonky produce. And therefore, they are damaging their margins even more.
This is absolutely fascinating. I understand you deliver I don't know if you have a discount code for the listeners, if anybody wants to sign up, but you can deliver the box. There are, three or four sizes of box? There's fruit only, mixture of fruit and vegetables,
yes.
And I think a vegetable-only box, yep. If I'm right.
So we've got four sizes, extra small, small, medium, and large, and in veg-only or fruit and veg, and then we've got a fruit box as well.
And you, intriguingly, to reduce your carbon footprint, you deliver overnight.
Yes, like the milkman.
So the box will be left outside your house typically, and you'd wake up in the morning rather like milk, and there'd be a box. So how do you deliver? You're obviously not using one of the main courier companies.
Yeah, so,
what's your delivery mode?
So we use a small delivery partner. The reason why we deliver overnight wasn't necessarily something that we thought at the start, let's deliver overnight. I was working full-time while starting Hotbox, and initially we were delivering early morning on Saturday, and then as we grew, we didn't have time to pack on Saturday morning, so we thought, let's pack on Friday night after work, and we were finishing the packing around midnight, 1 o'clock, and I didn't really fancy waiting till 5-6 in the morning for drivers to come and deliver the boxes. So we thought, why can't they come at midnight, and then they deliver overnight? It's going to be a lot faster for them because there's less traffic on the road, and therefore it's also more eco-friendly. And initially it started with freelance drivers, one of which then got some other drivers, so drivers who were also working for all the big logistics company. And it ended up with one of our first drivers setting up a company to deliver for us.
Wow. Okay. So you have your own effectively bespoke company.
Yes.
Does it have, does it supply any other people now? Are there other people who deliver overnight?
No. So he's in discussion with other people to deliver overnight, but we're his main customers.
Ah, interesting. Yeah, that's fantastic. Because actually it makes one of my arguments, funnily enough, in favor of locker delivery is that it makes it much easier to deliver either very late or very early to residential areas. And there isn't just the question of environmental sustainability. There's the whole question of the only category of road traffic that's significantly increasing is the delivery van. And it gets to a point where, you know, particularly at certain times of the day, it can't be much fun for the drivers. And it's not much fun for other road users either, for that matter. So this is fascinating. So he's effectively started this business of late night deliveries. Do you have any trouble with disturbing people or people wondering what the van is at 3 a.m?
So, no, somehow our drivers are very good at kind of being quite quiet. And we have people who have dogs and say, our dog don't even notice.
The dog that didn't bark in the night. That's a Sherlock Holmes
story. So
we have
sometimes instances where it's not necessarily ideal for a box to be left. If it's on a high street, then it's not ideal, but it's not ideal to do daytime deliveries either if people are in the office. We don't feel that the disadvantage of night delivery outweighs the benefits. There's a lot more benefits. And for people, it's quite nice that they open their door in the morning and their box is there. Mm. So again, like your milk, and they say, for people who have children, they say their children run to the door in the morning to kind of get the box, look what's inside. And so it's also a nice way to educate children about produce, where produce come from, and kind of have that joy as a family to open the box.
And actually, the randomness of it is weirdly an advantage, because it encourages you to think of doing things that you wouldn't otherwise do. There's that element of surprise which bizarrely makes the thing more. Funnily enough, that goes back to an old guy called Claude Hopkins, who said that in many cases, a mystery gift is actually a better promise than a specific gift, because the element of surprise actually adds to the both the anticipation and the enjoyment. Yeah. But also there's that wonderful choice reduction in it, which is that actually, you know, it nudges you into doing something, maybe making a soup or something similar, or a juice that you haven't tried before.
Yeah.
And actually discovering, you know, combinations that you wouldn't have necessarily thought of. So, I mean, I think you probably find that the level of waste within households is pretty low, is it? Because people learn to be just more versatile.
So I think it depends. And so that's for people who are quite experienced and confident cooks, not knowing what comes in the box is great, because they pretty much know what to do with any fruit and veg they get. And they are used to kind of making a roast and swapping different types of veg in their roast, making a curry and being quite creative and resourceful in terms of how they cook. For less confident cook, Hotbox can prove to be a challenge. And that's in some ways our biggest challenge in terms of being more mass market and attracting people to our mission around food waste. And that's something that we're working on in terms of how we can offer a bit more customization for people who've never cooked a cabbage. Because it can be quite a challenge to receive a big cabbage when you've never cooked one and you don't know what to do with it. And then it stays at the back of your fridge and it becomes food waste, and that goes against our ethos.
Do you provide any kind of information with the veg or cooking tips? Have you thought of including content or YouTube for that matter?
Yes. So from the start, we've been putting a letter in the box, and it's on the front part. There's a story about the produce. There's a story about the grower, or there's a story kind of about the industry and what's happening in the industry. Then we actually have shapes of the different types of produce so that people know exactly what's in the box, especially if there's something that they've never seen before. So, for example, Jerusalem artichokes, some people thought it was ginger, and it's true, it looks very similar. And if you've never had Jerusalem artichokes, it can be quite confusing to see several kind of roots or kind of ginger-type roots. And then we provide recipes, and we also provide tips in terms of what needs to be used first, how long it needs to be, it can be stored for, where it needs to be stored, and what can be frozen. So a lot of, and then we've got links to additional recipes on our website.
And this would work, I imagine, pretty brilliantly for anybody who either has a soup maker in particular. Yes. The other thing I've noticed that Gusto are starting to do is they're starting to do air fryer recipes. Mm. Because that seems to be an interesting technology. I've been evangelizing the air fryer for about the last 10 or 15 years.
Yeah, it's the latest trend.
Yeah, but it's actually, the funny thing is it's basically a miniature convection oven, but it's a bit more than that, actually, in fairness. But it's really interesting in that that will actually provide people with relatively convenient high-speed ways of preparing tray bakes and things of that kind. In 2020, Hotbox became B Corp certified. Why was that important? And what do you believe are the benefits for a company to become B Corp certified from a business perspective?
Yes, so B Corp is a certification which not only covers our environmental kind of footprint, but it's also about governance. It's also about how we treat our employees. It's also about how we engage with the community. So it's quite broad in terms of what it covers. And so it's about people, profit, and the planet. And for us, it was more to have that validation, external validation, that we were doing things right. Didn't want to be in a position where we could be called out for any greenwashing. And it's now quite a well-known certification. It's not easy to become a B Corp, and it's quite a lengthy process. And the main thing about B Corp is that it's not a one-off certification. Every B Corps need to recertify every 3 years, and there's a commitment that we need to improve on the scores that we had 3 years ago. And in addition to having to do an impact report, so we're just releasing our impact report for 2022, our commitment for 2023. And so it's there's a lot of requirements for explain what we are doing and to improve, to do more.
If I'm right, I think the B Corp also means that in terms of sort of fiduciary responsibility, it effectively means that you are not obliged to be 100% kind of profit or shareholder focused.
Yes.
And therefore, you to keep your B Corp status, you have to consider multiple stakeholders.
Yes, correct. So we had to change our governance documents to say that we operate not only for profit, but for people and the planet.
Got it. And so if I'm right, I think the B Corp started in the US and there was a company making, in some ways, kind of ethical clothing, which also was fairly benign towards its own employees. And they were forced to sell because, as shareholders, they were obliged to take this purchase offer, knowing that the purchaser would kind of destroy the brand. And they realized there was nothing they could do about this. And so one of the things is that it enables you, if you wish to exit, it places obligations on the person who buys you not to turn what is effectively a multifaceted, multi-stakeholder organization into a narrow kind of shareholder-only, shareholder value-focused organization.
Yeah, correct.
And so it's a kind of, it's wonderful for people who might wish to exit, but don't wish to see their life's work destroyed. Yeah. By quite often what happens, by the way, is people pursue this shareholder value thing, and unsurprisingly, perhaps, the customers notice. Okay. And so it isn't necessarily even good business, but it's kind of, particularly in the Anglo-Saxon world, it's a kind of obligation of any board member to look to the shareholder interest first. That strikes me as fundamentally intellectually incoherent, by the way, because which shareholder over which time frame should you be considering? It doesn't strike me. It looks very, very clear cut and single minded. But actually, when you delve a bit deeper, you realize that it's actually, you know, effectively, it's clarity achieved at the price of nuance and subtlety. And, you know, it's not even clear. Do you mean the short term shareholder interest, the 5-year shareholder interest? It actually raises more questions than it answers, to be absolutely honest. But I'm fairly sure My Supper Hero is also a B Corp, and it's increasingly common in this area of food innovation, which fascinates me.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
We have a regular podcast feature, by the way, called The Top Two Challenges. And there's even a jingle for it, which I think someone's going to play now.
Top Two Challenges, brought to you by Alf Insight.
Alf Insight helps media owners, agencies, and marketing service providers improve their new business pipelines by equipping them with in-depth insights, accurate information, and daily news updates on the leading and challenger brands in the UK. Alf now also helps sports clubs, venues, and charities with new partnership deals. Alf Insight identifies the brands to target at the right time, providing everything you need to tailor the perfect pitch. Visit Alf Insight, that's alfinsight.com, or click the link in the episode description to find out more. The first question is, what would you say is the biggest challenge for Oddbox, and what's the most pressing challenge for the grocery industry as a whole, in your opinion? So the first question is the top challenge for Oddbox itself. Is it simple growth? Do you have the potential to grow? Are there pretty good gains to scale when you grow, or is it supply? What's the constraint?
So right now we don't have any constraint on supplies. The biggest challenge is consumers are driven by convenience, and we've seen a lot of startups, so ultra fast delivery startups, where you can get everything you want delivered to you within 15 minutes. We're asking people to behave in a completely different way. We believe that people should cook based on what's available, what they have in their cupboard, what they receive from their hot box. And so it's quite a change in behavior. So we call that grower-led cooking and grower-led eating, which is cooking based on what's available. And that goes against a lot of the trends. That goes against the trend of increased convenience. And so for us, that's our biggest challenge in terms of how do we move people towards that whilst understanding that, and that's why we need to make our proposition a bit more convenient, where people can partially choose what comes in their hot box from a bigger selection, to get them on that journey to then being confident to always cook with what's in their fridge.
Yes, so I mean, I suppose Britain, a very interesting thing is Britain, by industrializing very, very early and urbanizing very, very early. So I think if I'm right, the figure is that in 1850, the majority of the British population lived in cities or large towns. That was 1850 in the UK. That figure was reached in the United States in 1920, and it was reached in France in 1950. So France, until, you know, immediate post-war France, was still, you know, a majority kind of rural area. So that whole idea of seasonality, which probably still retains some meaning in France and Italy. I mean, we've been disconnected from agriculture as a population, really, which probably explains why for a long time the food was so bad. You know, in other words, what you might call peasant or rural knowledge just got completely lost with fairly early urbanization.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because when you read earlier, sort of 19th century writing, you notice that, you know, patently, you know, there was great excitement about food coming into season and going out of season again. And strawberries, that business of strawberries in the winter, which actually I can date it because I was at university when it first happened, and it was Marks and Spencer's who did it first. And I think they flew stuff in from Chile, if I'm right. At the time, I mean that was pretty weird. In 1989, it would have been about 1987. It first appeared in our local M&S, I think. And now, since then, of course, there's a whole generation of people who don't even realize that strawberries kind of seasonal.
Yeah, that's what it's we just don't. People don't know because it's there in the retailers' shelves. So there's that notion of seasonality, that notion of what's grown in the UK is kind of lost. It's difficult when you live in a city to know what's in season. And even people think about local, and they have that notion that you can get a lot of things within 30 kilometers from where you live. Actually, a lot of produce are grown in specific regions of the UK, and you can't get, so Kent is really good for fruits, potatoes, and kind of all the brassicas, so the cabbages are more in the north. So there's specific soil good for specific produce. So it's very difficult to kind of have a varied diet if you only want things which are grown within 30 kilometers from where you live.
Of course, in the UK, weirdly, a lot of the UK's raspberries come from Scotland, which seems unusual, but that seems to be the case for ages. In fairness, actually, I think we ought to be clear about this. There's a debate about flying in fruit and vegetables in terms of food miles. I think the food miles debate, as far as land transportation goes, is actually a bit silly.
Yeah, just as an example, 1 kilo of potatoes requires 300 liters of water. That's the equivalent of 3 showers, in addition to all the labors, the land use, and potatoes take nothing to grow. So the environmental impact of food waste is so much higher, or the environmental impact of growing food is 25% of all greenhouse gas emission. And the impact of transporting food is very little compared to that, especially if it comes through land or sea. Air flying is bad, but land or sea freight has kind of quite a low carbon footprint.
Because actually, okay, I think what happens is people don't understand the network effect. Mm. And obviously, if someone drove from Scotland with a punnet of strawberries, okay, that that would be an appalling kind of carbon footprint in terms of each raspberry. But obviously, it doesn't work like that. And if you consider the volume that can be transported by road or by sea, then the number of actual incremental miles per raspberry on a mass shipment is absolutely minuscule. Mm-hmm. And so it's completely wrong, I think, to make that a consideration when there are far more important considerations, like not growing food in inappropriate places.
Yeah, and for example, going back to the tomatoes, growing tomatoes in the UK needs to be in greenhouses. Growing tomatoes in Spain can be outdoors, and the kind of energy requirement to grow them in the UK is a lot higher than the fuel usage to transport them from Spain to the UK.
So the way to think of it is that Spanish tomatoes are solar powered, and you are actually importing solar energy in a sense. Okay. Whereas if we need to use electricity to heat polytunnels or other forms of artificial growing, then you're absolutely right. Yeah, the transportation cost is absolutely trivial compared to the artificial energy cost. So, and this is one of the problems, which is: are you principally do you weight towards organic vegetables or fruit, or are you not?
No,
bothered?
We don't. And so we work with any type of produce growers. So we'll sometimes have some organic, but because it's mixed with conventional produce, we can't really call it organic. And that's why organic is always packaged, because if it touches conventional, it can't be called organic anymore.
I mean, I would have thought the point of organic food is that you eat organic. I thought the idea that you become kind of tainted by contact with anything else, that strikes me as a rather kind of extreme level of purity.
Yeah. And there's a lot of confusion about organic. So people don't really know. So obviously, organic producers still use kind of sprays and fertilizers, but that's organic certified fertilizers. So there's a lot of confusion on the value of organic. In mainland Europe, there's a much bigger push from the government towards organic. In the UK, it's not been the case. And so for us, we're about food waste. Food waste is a lot clearer in terms of food is grown, it shouldn't be wasted. When we don't have enough resources to feed all the people on the planet, then let's at least eat what we've grown. So that's kind of a lot more simpler to understand than organic. And that's why people buy Oddbox, because they think that by tackling food waste, they do something good for the planet.
Which they do, by the way. I mean, and actually, in a way, the very high figure of food waste, when it was first presented to us, I said, actually, the way to look at that is not with horror, but with optimism, because it suggests that actually, if we're just a bit more intelligent or a bit more discriminating, or we educate people better, there's the potential to feed far more people for no more money. So we shouldn't despair at that figure. We should look at it as an opportunity for improvement, and actually, in some ways, be quite optimistic about it. There are some odd. I mean, this is where it becomes very difficult, which is the whole concept of what is worthy and good for the planet. Sometimes it goes with people's natural instincts, but sometimes, as with food miles, The reality is completely different. I mean, one of the strange things I've learned is that composting is really rather bad because it produces a lot of methane, whereas waste disposal units, which seem like a complete American indulgence, are actually, if you have to get rid of, for example, peelings or other organic matter, it's better to put them down a waste disposal unit than it is to compost them in the garden. And so quite a lot of what is environmentally beneficial runs counter to our natural instincts.
Yeah, it's quite unclear. The whole area of sustainability is complex. It's got lots of different streams, and all of us are a bit confused in terms of what we should be doing, and it changes as well. So food waste is the only thing that it's very clear-cut in terms of we all know we shouldn't waste food when it's been produced.
So the other question is, in terms of the second challenge, what do you think the big challenge is for the grocery industry as a whole? Particularly around waste. Do you think there's an education challenge where people become less obsessed with the kind of perfection of appearance of food? Do you think there are? Do you think we actually need to basically get people back to being used to seasonality?
Yeah, I think we do. I think also on the grower side, retailers have a role to play in driving more reporting on the amount of waste which happens at farm level. So there's very little understanding of how much waste happens at farm level with suppliers, and that's the first step. So we need to know, we need to get the data, we need to understand why it happens, where it happens, and the reasons it happens, and for retailers to work in partnership with their suppliers to reduce that amount and to promote more of the seasonal produce when there's flushes.
That's fantastic. There may be other practices, which I remember working as a forklift truck driver at the Ribena factory in Colford back in the 80s. And it was noted that all the fruit suppliers used to spray the fruit with water before it set off, because you'd get a better price because it made it heavier. Now, those are the kind of practices that we need to, you know, in other words, you know, it patently is of no one's benefit, actually, just transporting water around the country in that shape or form, but they found it worthwhile. That's the kind of thing, this used to happen, by the way, with crisp manufacturers, that the potatoes were sprayed with water, and of course the big energy cost of making potato crisps is drying them out again. So you effectively had the organization was acting at loggerheads with its own suppliers. And so that, you know, better intelligent cooperation there can make a very big difference. You know, I don't know where the market's going to go entirely, but if you take the sudden profusion, particularly since lockdown, and I'm assuming that during lockdown you had a particularly good two years. How are you finding supplies now that supermarket shelves are quite often empty? Are you having difficulty getting hold of vegetables? What's the principal cause? Because it's a mixture of kind of climatic and other factors, isn't it? Is that right?
Yeah, there's a lot of different factors. So obviously we've had a very hot and dry summer. Then we had a cold spell in the winter. There's been a lot of floods in southern Europe. So that created challenges in terms of supply. Everybody's talking about tomatoes. So we used to grow more tomatoes in the UK a few years ago, but tomatoes in the UK are all grown in greenhouse, in green houses, and that requires a lot of energy, and therefore the cost of growing tomatoes in the UK has increased a lot, and retailers haven't necessarily been willing to pay more for UK tomatoes, and therefore a lot of tomato businesses have gone out of business over the past year in the UK, and so we're more dependent on imports from Southern Europe. and everything works on contract. It's also become more expensive for growers in Spain, in Morocco, to grow the tomatoes, and retailers haven't been willing to pay for that because there's no shortages in France, in Germany, because they've adjusted the price. So it's food is too cheap in the UK.
Yeah, it's funny you say that because it occurred to me that it wouldn't, given that these things are substitutable, it's not as if people are going to be starving to death, but it's simply limiting their diet. It's not a totally unhealthy thing for consumers to learn that these things aren't always abundantly available at a low price, and that actually we're part of a global system where there are knock-on effects. It's strange because we always think of the German retailers as being hyper price sensitive and very, 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 very low margin. But they've just hiked the prices and people have accepted them.
Yes, and actually the UK is the most competitive grocery environment, even more than the US, even more than anywhere else.
Yeah, we have something like an insane amount of floor space devoted to grocery retailing relative to the population. Yeah. And I suppose you're right. It is actually hyper competitive, isn't it? So you've got two German players, one small Dutch player. You've also got Asda, Tesco, Sainsbury's, all at scale, plus local providers, plus farmers markets. Yep. So it is going to be pretty competitive. But I mean, it seems a bit weird because in certain cases, consumers I would have thought would be fairly happy to pay the premium. It might be a case where the retailers have misjudged their customers, in fact. I can understand the retailer concern, which is they don't want to become accused of price gouging.
Yeah, I think so. It's funny because then they're squeezing the suppliers and suppliers are saying, we can't operate with such tight prices. And we've seen kind of some of the big FMCG brands having fights with retailers and withdrawing some of their products from the shelves for a few weeks. And at the same time, then there's governmental institution saying that food is too expensive and people can't afford food. But as a proportion of the household income, food in the UK is a much smaller proportion compared to what it is in other countries. So we're not spending a lot of money on food in the UK. But consumers are very price sensitive.
In my childhood, I seem to remember that the average French family spent more than double the proportion of income on food that the average English family did. Now, that's probably changed. That was when I was kind of 10 or 11. That's probably changed, but a little bit. As Britain's become more foodie. But that's interesting because you could argue that even if we have fairly dramatic food price hikes, then the proportion that Brits spend on food would still be, probably below the Southern European average.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. That's very, very interesting. Do we spend more on eating out? I was just wondering, because that's another consideration, which is, in the United States, the amount spent eating out now exceeds the amount spent eating at home.
Yeah, there's a lot of takeaways.
That includes fast food takeaways and everything else. But actually, the US reached a point about 5 years ago where the average American household spent more eating either out of home or food prepared out of home. Than they did actually on eating at home.
Yeah, I'm not surprised.
That's kind of an extraordinary trend in the sense that, when I wasn't part of it, we weren't particularly impoverished by any means, but, when I was a child, we probably ate out four times a year or something of that kind. And so that's another change. But what's interesting is this, I think this counter change of quality cooking at home and people actually becoming more and more interested.
Yeah, and we've seen that. Obviously, COVID has helped with that trend. People were at home. There was everybody was baking and making their own bread during COVID. Now we're seeing that going back to pre-COVID behaviors, where last year there was a peak in people traveling and people eating out. But I think we'll see that switching back a bit more in terms of it's a lot healthier to cook at home.
Yes. I think there was an element post-COVID, and you saw the same thing with international travel. There was an element of people making up for lost time, and if you like, kind of almost overcompensating to a degree. And I think, I mean, one of the lessons of COVID probably was that we've been neglecting simple pleasures. And that one of the things a lot of people discovered during COVID is how much they enjoyed, as you said, you know, relatively simple things like baking. Provided you have the discretionary time, are really quite a large source of happiness. Yeah. And I wouldn't expect that lesson to be completely lost on us. You never know. You know, some people at least there must be some degree of stickiness. I mean, the crowdfunding campaign, if I'm right, closed at the end of February. Yes. How did your crowdfunding go?
We had amazing results from the crowdfunding campaign. Lots of over 2,500 people participated in the crowdfunding, and so we knew we've got a very engaged community. We knew that people wanted to do more to support our journey, and so we've had amazing results, and so many people join us.
And what do you plan to do with the money?
So we're looking at expanding our range. So food waste don't happen only with produce. There's food waste across the whole food chain. So a lot of brands that we all buy have surplus stock, have packaging issues, have slightly short-dated products. So for example, we've worked with Caravan Coffee, who have used some of the beans which were slightly short-dated to make some coffee for in partnership with Oddbox that we're selling through our boxes. We've worked with Montezuma Chocolate, who've repackaged broken slabs of chocolate that we sell through our boxes. And we work with a lot of different brands to help support them when they have surplus stock. So that's one of the things. As I mentioned, a lot of people sometimes struggle with getting an Oddbox and getting produce that they've never cooked before. So a big cabbage, when you've never cooked cabbage, is a challenge. So we're going to introduce some element of customization so that people can swap cabbage with something else to make it a bit easier for everyone to join Oddbox.
Interesting. Well, one of the things I'd like to teach the British to do, actually Europeans to do, is to make American-style salads as well, because I think the European or British salad is an exercise in self-denial to some extent. And actually, one of the things I noticed when I go to the United States, bizarrely, is after about day three, I actually eat more healthily because a salad actually constitutes a proper meal. That's another thing. And also the idea that frying is unhealthy. I remember having a debate about this, saying that one thing about the Saturday fry up is it's pretty good at getting rid of food waste, because you know, the frying pan is a place where you can experiment with pretty interesting combinations.
Yeah, there's lots of ways. So soups, stews, curries.
Yeah.
You can basically put pretty much any vegetables. But quite often, people are a bit worried or don't know or don't have the confidence to kind of do that.
What's your best acquisition medium, without giving away any trade secrets? You use door drops. I know you've used TV, some outdoor radio, direct mail, and digital, obviously, which makes sense. Which is your best, or in terms of volume and effectiveness, not just efficiency, where have you had the best results?
So I think it's changed over time. So at the start, we were doing quite a lot of local fairs and markets just to explain what Oddbox was, showcase the box. We've done a lot of door-to-door leafleting. That's worked really well in terms of being quite targeted. Initially, we started only in London, so we needed an acquisition channel where we could target people where we were able to deliver. So DoorDrop is amazing for that. We've done quite a lot of digital. Referrals has been one of our best channel as well, just word of mouth, people talking to their friends and their neighbors about Hotbox, and in some ways that's probably the best way to grow a brand and get people to hear from their friends about a product.
Oh, that's tremendous. So what's next? Is it geographical expansion, new channels? What's the experiment or the the expansion plan that appeals to you most?
Yes, so we now cover close to 70% of the UK, so there's a bit more that we can do in terms of geo expansion. We'll be looking at expanding to other countries in mainland Europe, but that's more planned for in the next 2 to 3 years. Right now, our focus is on the UK. We're also excitingly launching Hotbox branded products. So we've partnered with one of our apple growers who created a new breed of apple called the Lilybet for the Queen's Jubilee. For one of the retailers, that retailer decided not to take the old crop. And so that grower was left with tons of apples that he couldn't sell. We've put quite a few of them in our boxes, and we've now pressed some of these apples into an apple juice. So we've got an Hotbox branded apple juice that we're going to be selling in our boxes in the next few weeks. And there's lots of opportunities for products made with rescued produce. We've got access to a lot of different suppliers. So for us, that's a very exciting opportunity.
Well, I suppose there is the opportunity to take the brand into physical retail.
So that's something that we can test products in our boxes and then create branded products that we sell through other channels.
I think what's really worthwhile about this is not only is what you're doing, you know, incontestably a good thing, and as you say, it's a win-win, but more than that, it's actually readily comprehensible to the public. Because as we were saying earlier, there's so many of these things where actually the environmental thing to do is slightly counterintuitive or unexpected. And here is something which I think people can immediately grasp, which is, in other words, I get interesting stuff at a fair price.
Yep.
That's you know, genuinely tasty, because it's the stuff that the retailers are too anal to take and display on their shelves. And it's such an obvious kind of, you know, the whole idea of offcuts, yeah, as it were, or bin ends, is immediately comprehensible to the customer. So I think that's absolutely tremendous. Well, what I can say is, Emily, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today. You've been listening to On Brand with Alf and Rory Sutherland. If you want to do business with Hotbox or any other grocery brand, just contact the Alf Insight team on their website, which is www.alfinsight.com. That's alfinsight.com. If you want, of course, to sign up to Hotbox, there's a special sign-up code ALF, A-L-F, which will get you 50% off your first box. You can also find the link in the episode description. This series, as ever, is produced and edited by Ultimate Sound and Vision. And to make sure you receive the next episode, please do subscribe. And if you've enjoyed what you've heard, then do us the tidy and give us a like. Thanks for listening, and here's to next time.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.